From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, screenwriter and director John Waters, one of the eccentric icons of the independent film world. On Saturday, he'll host the Independent Spirit Awards for the Independent Film Channel. He's completing a new movie. In the meantime, he has a new exhibition of photos that he's taken of movies off his TV screen. His photos pay tribute to some of his favorite movies and actors. The exhibition and companion book are called Change of Life. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan told members of Congress today that they should consider cutting Social Security benefits before the increasing cost of benefits drives the federal deficit even higher. Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry, campaigning in Ohio, said Social Security would be off limits if he were president. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from Toledo, Ohio.
Kerry told a rally at the University of Toledo that he would roll back the Bush administration's tax cut for the wealthiest Americans to invest in education, health care, and jobs. He said the president is adding $1 million a minute to the deficit, but Kerry said while he would restore fiscal sanity in Washington, he wouldn't do it with Social Security cuts.
The wrong way to cut the deficit is to cut Social Security benefits. If I'm president, we're simply not going to do it.
Ohio has lost some 160,000 manufacturing jobs during the Bush administration. Kerry said he would require companies give their employees 3 months' notice if they send their jobs offshore. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Toledo.
President Bush said today that the United States would like to see a multinational effort to restore security to Haiti. Mr. Bush also warned that the U.S. will not accept Haitian refugees.
I have made it abundantly clear to the Coast Guard that we will turn back any refugee that attempts to reach our shore. And that message needs to be very clear as well to the Haitian people.
France is calling for an international police force to help keep order in Haiti, along with humanitarian observers. Opponents of same-sex marriage are asking the California Supreme Court to stop the city of San Francisco from issuing marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples. The suit also seeks to nullify the more than 3,000 same-sex marriages that have already been performed. More than 100 gay men and lesbians in Florida are suing to overturn the state's ban on same-sex marriages. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
Florida's gay marriage ban violates the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. So says the plaintiff's lawyer, Ellis Rubin. Rubin says more than 175 people have signed on to the suit as co-plaintiffs. The challenge names Broward County Clerk Howard Foreman. As clerk, Foreman is in charge of issuing marriage licenses. The dispute began on Monday when a gay couple went to the courthouse in Fort Lauderdale seeking a marriage license. Foreman said he had no choice but to turn them down. Florida's law defines marriage as only between a man and a woman. It has been on the books since 1977. Florida Governor Jeb Bush says he supports Florida's gay marriage ban and he'll uphold the law as it's written. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
The Dow gained 35 today to close at 10,601. The Nasdaq was up 17 to 2023. This is NPR News. Football star Jamal Lewis was indicted today on federal drug charges. The Baltimore Ravens running back is charged with conspiring to possess and resell 5 kilograms of cocaine in the summer of 2000. A U.S. attorney in Atlanta said Lewis is expected to turn himself in to authorities there tomorrow. Lewis had the second highest rushing total in NFL history last season. A former Tufts University president has been named to help the University of Colorado determine whether its athletes mistreat women. Over the past 2.5 years, 6 women have come forward to say they were raped by Colorado football players or recruits. NPR's Jeff Brady reports from Denver.
John DiBiagio retired from Tufts in 2001 and has called on fellow academic leaders to rein in their athletic departments. University of Colorado President Elizabeth Hoffman has been criticized for not responding sooner to rape allegations against her football players. Hoffman says DiBiagio will be her eyes and ears during an upcoming investigation.
It is extremely important that we deal with both of these issues, and bringing in somebody with our level of experience at this moment in time allows us to do both, as it were.
Hoffman says DiBiagio will remain on staff until a panel completes its investigation of the athletic department in April. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
The California Public Employees Retirement System, or CalPERS, said today that it will not vote to reelect Michael Eisner as the CEO of the Walt Disney Company. CalPERS is the nation's largest public pension fund. CalPERS President Sean Harrigan called Eisner's performance dismal. Eisner is in a fight with dissident shareholders, including Roy Disney, who want to oust him. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Ladies and gentlemen, please do not panic, but scream! Scream for your lives! The tingler is loose in this theater, and if you don't scream, it may kill you. Scream! Scream! Keep screaming! Scream for your lives! It's here! It's over here! Help! Help!
Look out, it's under the seat!
Ladies and gentlemen,
look out, it's under the seat!
The tingler has been paralyzed by your screaming. There is no more danger. We will now resume the showing of the movie.
That's Vincent Price in a scene from The Tingler, directed by William Castle. Castle's low-budget shock and hype made him a hero to screenwriter and director John Waters. Waters has become one of the icons of the independent film world. This Saturday, for the fourth time, he will host its version of the Academy Awards, the Independent Spirit Awards, produced and televised by the Independent Film Channel. Waters started his own filmmaking career, setting new lows in bad taste, most notably with the cult classic Pink Flamingos. His film Hairspray, which is adapted into the hit Broadway musical, was an affectionate and funny homage to the teen dance show he used to watch in Baltimore. His next movie, A Dirty Shame, is scheduled for release later this year. In the meantime, he has an exhibition at the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York of the photographic series he began in the early 90s. A companion book called Change of Life has just been published. Many of photographs in the book and exhibition are tributes to Waters' favorite films, which, not surprisingly, include many old exploitation films and tawdry melodramas. I asked him to describe the photographic series in the exhibition.
Basically, all it's sort of like a storyboard, if you know what that is, what you do when you're planning a shot, when you do a drawing of the action of each shot in a row, where you sort of read it left to right. And all the photographs, many of them, are taken off the TV screen in the dark, not with digital cameras, not with freeze frame, just like a crazed fan in the dark with a camera. And then I take images from either my own movies or others, many other movies, and put them in order as if I am writing a new movie with those images.
How did you start doing this?
I started doing it because I wanted a still from one of my own movies that I didn't have. I wanted this shot in Multiple Maniacs where right after Divine is attacked and raped by a female impersonator, and 1 second later the Infant of Prague, a Catholic saint very popular in Baltimore, appears to him. And I wanted a shot of that, and I didn't have it. So then I realized I wanted stills from other movies, ones that they would never release, like in a movie called Susan Slade, a movie I liked very much, a Troy Donahue, Connie Stevens kind of teen shocker that I saw when I was 12. And I remember the one scene, her illegitimate baby catches on fire in it. And I thought, oh, my God, I was so shocked. So I wanted a still of that, even though, of course, they would never do it. So I started making stills of movies that would never, ever be done. And that led to making my own little movies out of many tiny parts of other people's movies, sometimes a close-up of a frame of a movie.
Now, you also have a photographic sequence of stills from the movie Peyton Place. Would you describe how you chose the stills from the film?
Well, Peyton Place was the first dirty book I ever read. I love Grace Natalia.
How dirty was it? I've never read the book.
The V of Betty's Crotch.
Uh-huh, okay.
About that dirty. But in 1956, that was pretty dirty. And, it's a great... You ought to read Peyton Place. There's many sequels to it. It opens up, Indian Summer is like a woman. That's the first line. but Grace Metellus, you know, has that famous author shot of her in the lumber jacket and the dirty ponytail sitting at the typewriter. And I was so obsessed, I even went to her grave. I went in her house where she wrote the book. But Peyton Place itself, when the book came out, I remember the ad campaign is, how did they make a movie out of Peyton Place or something like that. But whenever they got to a sexual scene, they would cut to a cutaway shot of symbolism, like if someone was frigid, they'd have a frozen lake, or if somebody was getting turned on, they'd show a blossom in spring. So it was all corny nature shots, and it looks like bad National Geographic shots, but actually it's dirty shots. It's what they couldn't show then. So I tried to concentrate on what was thought of as sexy then, and to show today how ludicrous, but maybe even sexier if you don't see it, because we're so used to seeing everything today.
That's really funny. And you also have a series of stills of Dorothy Malone, who starred in the TV series Peyton Place, with her collar turned up. What is it about her collar that you find so absorbing?
Well, I like to do a star's career, their biography, by a tiny detail in their life. I did one called Grace Kelly's Elbows, where basically I noticed she had the most beautiful elbows, so I just took photographs of her elbows, like an elbow stalker. But Dorothy Malone always seemed to have her collar up. It was her signature in all the movies. So I started photographing just her collar. Now, I really hated it when she was in a period movie because period costume, she couldn't wear her collar up. But and I finally met Dorothy Malone, and I had dinner with her, and she didn't have her collar up, and I was so disappointed. And I tried to tell her about the series, and she just looked at me like I was crazy and turned her collar up. But I think you can find any star and zero in on the one tiny thing you like about them best, and then watch the movie only looking at her collar. It makes the movie so different.
When you were growing up and you started to watch films passionately, who were your first favorite movie stars?
My first favorite movie stars? I guess Elvis Presley. You know, I liked directors when I was young. I liked William Castle. I liked Kroger Babb, the one that they told us we'd go to hell if we saw his movies.
Who's
where
that?
He did Mom and Dad. He showed The Birth of a Baby for the first time. And he was a carny. He later even made a movie called One Too Many that he only showed at AA meetings, which I really like. That's a new kind of exploitation that I'm all for. I'm a carny too, basically.
What are the movies that you used to watch over and over again as a kid on TV or going to the movies time and time again to see it?
Yes, certainly. The Tingler, all the William Castle movies. And I did a piece in the show that shows William Castle's face. No, it shows William Castle's face, and then it has Alfred Hitchcock next to him, because everybody accused William Castle, who was king of the gimmicks in his films, of ripping off Alfred Hitchcock. But in a way, it was the other way around, because Alfred Hitchcock, people forget, when Psycho came out, the big ad campaign was that no one can enter the theater once the feature has begun, which was unheard of at the time. You forget. People used to go to the movies at any time and just stay through to the next part of the film. They never cleared the theater. So there was a clock in every box office, so you'd know. And it was a big, big gimmick. So in a way, he was king of the gimmicks also, and he copied William Castle, who in a way did it first. So I've always, in a way, liked the second rate better. I mean, William Castle I liked more than Alfred Hitchcock, Jane Mansfield I liked more than Marilyn Monroe. Sal Mineo, I liked him really a lot, though. I didn't feel he was inferior, but he was maybe, I liked Sal Mineo even more than James Dean. I always liked the wrong person. I always rooted for the wrong person, and I always thought that the people that other people thought were ugly were better looking. That's always been my life, and my career has kind of been based on that.
I know you really like the carny pitch for a movie like the William Castle, Come On, but were there movies that you felt really cheated by because they promised like sin and sex and sleaze and they didn't deliver?
I never feel cheated when I go to the movies. Even if I hate it, it's an experience. It's a cinematic experience. And that's why I started taking these pictures. There's no such thing as a bad movie. If you go to a movie watching detail only, if you really hate the movie, just look at the lamps in it and pretend the movie is about lamps. And then never is it boring. It's always exciting and it's always surprising. You can even see continuity mistakes within the lamps.
You also have a series called Inga that are, this is stills from a Swedish, quote, art film?
Well, art film. Art meant dirty when I was young, and that's the way it should stay. Inga was one of the Sweden, you know, the Bergman movies, when they first came out in Baltimore, were sold as sex films because they had a little bit of nudity in them. And Sweden became a code word for dirty. It's still, the dirty bookshop in Baltimore is called the Sweden Bookshop. I'm not making this up. So I love the idea. I tried to put Inga in, but I just showed the back of somebody. I showed no nudity. I showed the one shot in a sex film that you would never reproduce, that would never become a still. It is the sexy girl walking away from you out of focus, a shot that no one would ever produce. All the stills in this show are ones that would never be produced. I did a whole series called Marks, where I just took photographs off the floor when I was making my movie Pecker of the tape marks that the crew puts down that the actors have to hit to stay in focus. And that's the only thing in the shot. Everything that would be in a movie is gone. The actors, the costumes, the props, and all that's left is the one thing you can't show in a movie still.
Since a few of the shots in your book allude to, you know, erotic movies or porn movies, I'm wondering how you discovered pornography as a kid.
Gee, how did I discover porn as a kid? Peyton Place was the first dirty book I had ever read, and I had heard about it, certainly. Mandingo was another one, and that's like kind of a great movie. And Playboy. I mean, Playboy was the first thing that you could ever really see. Now, gay porn was a very, very different thing. There was a store called Sherman's downtown that had those magazines like Vim and Vigor, and they were supposedly Muscle Man magazines, but it was kind of a coded thing. It was the first gay magazines I ever saw.
Did your father have pornographic books or men's magazines around that you could sneak peeks at?
No, he didn't. But he did have Peyton Place, and I did read his copy of Peyton Place.
Did he read that because that was the kind of book he liked, or because that was the only kind of like legitimate erotic literature,
you know,
he could read?
I don't know that. You'd have to ask my father that, and I doubt he'd answer. But everyone had Peyton Place. My grandfather had Peyton Place. Peyton Place was the biggest number one bestseller for weeks and weeks and weeks. And it led to Jackie Suzanne. It led to Jackie Collins. It led to that entire genre of work. But she did it first, and she did it best, and she had such great titles. Another one of her books was The Tight White Collar, about a priest. That's such a good title. But she didn't handle success so well. I mean, she divorced her husband, she moved to the Plaza Hotel, and she drank too much and died, basically. So that's not the best success story. But the book was so famous that when I went back to New Hampshire, where she wrote the book, they still talk mean about her there in the town. And the library only had one tattered copy. But I did go to her grave. And Grace has been a great heroine of mine. And actually, Roseanne Barr should play her in the movie because she could really play her well, actually.
What was her gravesite like?
Ostentatious and much larger than any of the other gravestones there. And people leave liquor bottles near it sometimes.
My guest is screenwriter and director John Waters. The exhibition of his photographs is at the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is screenwriter and director John Waters. His new museum exhibition and companion book are called Change of Life, and they collect the photographs of movies that he's taken off his TV screen. When you started finding pornography, straight pornography, what was it like reading or seeing photos that were fetishizing women's bodies when women's bodies weren't what it was about for you?
Well, when I looked at those pictures, I always looked at it in a way to see how far it could go. The same way I went to heterosexual sexploitation movies all the time that had no male nudity to see how far it could go. I was interested in how the taboos would fall, how it started with nudist camp movies were the first things I saw, and you would see bare breasts on women and sometimes asses. But once in a while, a male ass. But they had to be playing volleyball, so, you know, that was not so erotic to me. It's hard to imagine, even on your horniest night, a sexy volleyball fantasy. So a naked volleyball fantasy. I've never had a night where I'm that horny. Let's put it that way. So I just kept watching and to see how far it could go. Each time something crumbled, no matter if it, I guess certainly in the heterosexual world with sexual imagery, when that began to crumble, you knew that the homosexual imagery was not far behind, but the heterosexual had to crumble first.
How did you get to see the nudist camp movies? And these were movies that ostensibly were supposed to be documentaries about healthy alternative lifestyles and so on, but they were really about the nudity. Where did they play? Where did you get to see them?
I can tell you right where. One of my favorite theaters, the Rex Movie Theater in Baltimore, which is now a church. Mm-hmm. When I was young, it started out, and I saw The Wizard of Oz there, but it later became a nudie movie theater where I not only saw nudist camp movies, I saw the early Russ Meyer movies, I saw the Ghoulies and the Ruffies, and it was one man who owned it who fought the censorship board. We had the Maryland Censorship Board, and censorship has always been something I fought, and I even have a piece in the show where a curtain goes over the imagery for censorship in case your parents are coming over, that you can close it. So I've always dealt with censorship. So the Rex Theater was where I got a lot of my film education in Baltimore.
Did you ever feel guilty for your tastes that were about violating all the standards of decency?
No, I never felt guilty. I always knew. I told the story before, but when I was young, I heard my parents talking about me. You know, you listen at the top of the steps, and my mom said, "Well, he's just an odd duck," and I thought, "Well, that's it." You know, so I didn't really ever care that the other kids weren't interested in what I was in, because as long I had a very rich fantasy life, and my parents allowed that. I had a little stage even as a kid. My parents bought me a reel-to-reel tape recorder so I could tape songs. I was the first downloader ever because I, with a reel-to-reel tape recorder, tape songs off the radio. But then, so I could sing them all and lip-sync them, basically. So I was a puppeteer as a kid. I had a job. I had a career when I was 12 years old as a puppeteer. So I always had an outlet for this that was encouraged, even though the work I was doing was probably, to this day, horrifying my parents. It was not exactly the work that they wished I was doing. But I guess they figured it was this or nothing, maybe, or prison. But they were very supportive, which was very, very, very encouraging. And I always say that. If you've got a kid that doesn't fit in, is rebelling in any way, encourage it. If your daughter comes home and she's just had her entire face tattooed, what can you do? Maybe she'll open a tattoo parlor that will do well. That's all you can do. You got to deal with what you got.
Since you didn't feel guilty about watching things and being obsessively interested in things that weren't supposed to be healthy, did you go the other direction and figure, well, I might as well play it up to the hilt and be, you know, take on the pose of the pervert?
No, I never thought of it that way. I had to create a persona for myself in the beginning when we made these movies because I didn't have any advertising. No one knew who I was. We had to think of a way to publicize the movies. And Divine and I did that sort of as I was the director and he was the insane movie star. And certainly I dressed weirdly, but it was always confusing. My audience in the beginning was never gay or straight. It was gay people that didn't like other gay people. It was straight. It was hippies that didn't like hippies. It was always the outsider of another outsider group. That's what my audience began with. And certainly I encourage that. But it seemed to work because, yes, in the beginning, underground movies when I made them, and three of them are showing at the New Museum Show. They've never been shown ever except the one time I made them in 1964, 1966, and 1967. But they were made in a way to offend the very people who would come there, in a humorous way, though, always. By doing the whole Kennedy assassination, which we did, and Divine plays Jackie Kennedy, and it was shot in 1965 and came out in 66. Believe me, that was didn't go over very well at the time. But at the same time, it was a liberal taboo. I mean, I liked Kennedy. I loved Jacqueline Kennedy, or Jacqueline Kennedy is how she pronounced it. So I was always making fun of things that I really, really liked and respected.
Why don't you describe what you did in your version of the Kennedy assassination with Divine in the role of Jackie Kennedy?
Well, this was in a movie called Eat Your Makeup, and it's about people that kidnap models and force them to eat their makeup and model themselves to death. And Divine was not the star of it. He was a supporting player in it. And there's a scene where Divine is in drag, just weird drag, but with no wig on, because we were trying to even offend, I guess, drag queens at the time by not taking it seriously. And he starts looking through all these Jacqueline Kennedy magazines, what there were many of at the time, fan magazines, and he starts to imagine himself as Jacqueline Kennedy in the Kennedy assassination. And we have the whole thing, the cavalcade, I mean, a pitiful version, but we have the chauffeur, we have all the people that were in the car, we have Secret Service agents, and Divine is waving to the crowds. There are no crowds. It was filmed on my parents' street in Lutherville, Maryland, Morris Avenue. and then it is scored to a classical music where there's one note that is the gunshot, and then Divine crawls over the trunk of the car with the blood and everything. And it's quite graphic. But it was filmed so primitively, that's a nice way to say badly, black and white, 16-millimeter grainy, overexposed, that when I took pictures of it 25, 30 years later, it began to look like the real Zapruder film, one of the most famous 8-millimeter movies ever. So, I did a photo piece based on that, pictures of something I did a long time ago. And it goes around the wall, around a corner of the wall, because I always joke that I'm a carny. Well, I believe in the art world that the frame is the hype. The frame is the advertising campaign. So to me, it was too big for one wall. And it has to go around the wall.
And for any of our listeners who aren't familiar with Divine, who in this film that you're referring to played Jackie Kennedy, Divine was a very heavy man who usually played a woman in your movies and patterned himself in some of those roles on Elizabeth
yes.
Taylor. And what did you think of real drag queens at the time?
Well, they were square at the time. You know, I think Divine helped make drag queens a lot hipper. They all wanted to be Bess Meyerson. And they... they were really square. They weren't hip ever. Now all drag queens are hip. I mean, you see them at Wigstock, and they're all really funny, and they have a sense of humor, and they have funny names and everything. But then they were very, very serious. I remember in Philadelphia, there's a great movie called The Queen about a drag beauty contest in Philadelphia. I know where you live. And Harlow was the winner, and a very, very famous drag queen. But we used Elizabeth Coffey, who was at the time... much more ludicrous and much more funny and had a sense of humor about it and used being a drag queen as being a comedy terrorist, which I think was much more useful in film than just a man trying to be a pretty woman.
John Waters' exhibition of photographs is at the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of The Cloud Atlas, a novel set in Alaska during World War II by Liam Callanan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's Madison time. Hit it.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with John Waters. We're listening to a record on the soundtrack of his film Hairspray. And David Edelstein reviews Mel Gibson's new film, The Passion of the Christ.
I want you to go two up and two back with a big strong turn and back to the medicine. Hit top. You're looking good.
two up and two back, double cross, come out of it with the rifleman. Hit tuck. Hit it. I want the big strong M. Erase it and back to the mat. Hit it. Walk on, you're looking good. Now then, when I say hit it, it'll be tea time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with screenwriter and director John Waters. His movies include Pink Flamingos, Polyester, Hairspray, and Pecker. This Saturday, he'll host the Independent Spirit Awards, produced and televised by the Independent Film Channel. Waters has an exhibition at the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York, featuring photographs of movies that he's taken off his TV screen. The exhibition and companion book are called John Waters' Change of Life. They actually include more than the photos he's taken. You also have in your show stills from your collection, publicity shots and things, shots you didn't take yourself but that you really love for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. One of them is a real cheesecake photo of Jane Mansfield. Describe the pose that she's in.
I'm trying to think. I do have a piece in the show called Jane, which is Jane Mansfield on a man's eyeglasses cracking when he looks at her, which I love that, you know. Because Divine was my Jane Mansfield. We tried to put Godzilla and Jane Mansfield together to come up with Divine. But Jane had that great scene in The Girl Can't Help It where she's walking down the street and the ice man is unloading a big block of ice and all the ice melts when he looks at her. So I love that, you know. And I've actually was with Divine before, when Divine was walking down the street and caused a car accident from people gawking and smashed right into another car. I've seen that happen.
Now, early in your career, you said, and this is quoted in the catalog for your show, that your work is really about the sadness normal people feel because they're not involved in show business.
Well, somebody said that was the snottiest thing I ever said. I didn't mean it to be snotty. But I believe that most everybody secretly imagines themselves in show business, and every day on their way to work, they're a little bit depressed because they're not.
Well, do you think that explains the obsession with celebrity in American culture?
It explains why people are on Prozac. It explains...
Well, there's more reasons than that.
It explains why now if you go to a psychiatrist, they don't talk. They offer you pills. I believe in the talking cure. And if they did more of the talking cure, they would find out that it's all one reason. People are sad. They're not famous in America.
I guess you really needed to be famous.
Well, I certainly can't complain about it. I hate to hear people that are in show business that complain about any of that kind of thing. Well, what on earth did you pick that field to go in for if you didn't want people to recognize you? I've always said that show business is filled with the most insecure people of all, that we base a life on having to get approval of strangers from everything we do over and over and over on each project.
You know, in your book, there's lots of stills of movies and lots of stills from movies that were transgressive in their time or, you know, violating some taboo in some small way. You also have two...
Or failed.
Yeah. But you also have a couple of photos of Clarabel, the clown from Howdy Doody. not known as the most... But. Okay, next
Clarabel.
To that. Yes.
He was psychotic. Look at him. It was the first thing. And I was on the Howdy Doody show. My parents took me. I was on the Peanut Gallery at NBC Studios. Clarabel was a psychotic clown who never spoke, who honked a horn and shot you in the face with seltzer water. And, you know, Captain Kangaroo and Clarabel were the same person. Imagine that life. That's almost like the Holy Trinity. All he needed to be was Mr. Rogers. If he had gone to the next generation, he could have been all three things. I think Clarabel was frightening in the best sense of the word. It was the first psychotic person I remember from my childhood, his character.
Did Bob Keeshan play Clarabel?
Yes.
Ah, if I knew that, I'd
There was a couple Clarabels. Yes, he was the first Clarabel.
Huh.
So you really saw Clarabel as this psychotic character.
Well, to me he was, but I loved him. I loved Flubadub was my first fashion influence, too. Flubadub was very come de garçon, if you look at his outfits.
I'm sure Flubadub felt the same way.
Oh, thank you. When he saw me as a child, watching him lovingly in the peanut gallery.
So was that your first brush with real show business, being in the peanut gallery of the heavy duty show?
And I saw it was fake. It was all a lie. And rather than be the disillusioned child, I was in on the secret, and I wanted to stay in on it.
So you did puppet shows as a kid?
Yeah, for a long time.
What kind of characters?
Well, hand puppets, and I did Cinderella, and then later Punch and Judy. But at the end, I would come out from behind the stage, which is like breaking the third wall of puppetry, and say to the kids, you know, stick out your hand, and the dragon puppet will bite it for good luck. 3/4 of the kids cheered, and they loved it, and go crazy. The rest of them had nervous breakdowns and started sobbing. And this is basically what I still do.
When you did your puppet version of Cinderella, Cinderella wasn't like a drag queen or anything, right?
No, it's hard to have drag queen puppets. No, Cinderella was drab. It's the dullest part in the play. I mean, I love the stepsisters. I probably hovered on the scene too long when they rip her clothes off when she's all dressed for the ball. I always loved that scene. I even think I did that scene in Mondo Trasho later. I always liked the villains. I love the stepmother. I love the Wicked Witch. I always liked the villains. So in all my movies and all my photographs, really, there is no such thing as a villain. The ingenue is the villain.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Waters, and he has a new show at the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York. The show is called Change of Life, and it features his still photographs from movies rearranged to tell his version of the story, or at least a new story. There's also a companion book called John Waters, Change of Life. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Waters, the screenwriter and director, and he has a new museum show at the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York. It's called Change of Life, and it features still photographs that he's taken of many of his favorite movies. There's also a book of the same name, Change of Life. In the catalog, you know, in the book that is a companion to your museum show, you say, you're quoted as saying, "I don't think there's anything that's trash anymore. The golden age of trash has long been over because irony ruined it." How did irony ruin trash?
Because good exploitation never was so bad it was good. It was not made for the intelligentsia. It was not made to be ironic. It was not made to be so bad it was good. I always wish my films could play at drive-ins and exploitation houses, but they never did because of irony. Those movies were made to be sexy for real or to be violent for real. They were never meant to mean something else or to be so bad they were good. So now everybody has irony. I don't think you can make, even horror films now are ironic. There is no such thing left as true sexploitation or exploitation because irony has ruined it. Everybody's in on the joke now. Everybody's hip. Everybody has irony. No one takes anything at face value anymore. I'm guilty of it. I deal in irony like a drug dealer. That's everything I do is based on irony. I'm an irony addict.
Something else that you've said that's quoted in the catalog that I want to mention, and this is in reaction to a quote from the Warhol star Bridget Berlin. She said, "How can you be bad? How can you be bad in your 50s? And you said in response to that, "Taking drugs when you're young can be mind-expanding if it doesn't kill you, but if you're still doing it in mid-career, it's called addiction. Being insane when you're young is sexy. Insane at 50 is pitiful. I'm glad I got to be bad when I was young." Can you talk a little bit more about that?
The only way it can be bad later in life is to do it through your work. I mean, through your films, your artwork, your photographs. Then you can be bad. I have some bad pieces in my show. There's a piece called, 12 Assholes and a Dirty Foot. And that's certainly being bad. But at the same time, what I said there is true. It's only fun if you're beginning to be a big rebel. I think if you haven't learned something and refined it and kept going with it and using humor and hopefully wit with it, being shocking is easy. That's not hard. But being shocking in a way that makes you laugh and maybe makes you look at something in a different way and change how you see it is much harder. And I think that is sort of your duty if you're using humor as you continue on in your career.
Can I ask you what your impressions of aging are so far? You're, what, in your 50s now?
Yes, 57.
Yeah, so, you were so long known as, like, the young subversive filmmaker. And now you've kind of come into a different identity, which is more like the mentor and the icon for a lot of independent filmmakers.
A filth elder.
Oh, couldn't have put it better myself.
I'm fine. I still feel like I'm 12 years old, basically. When I do video signings and I go to colleges a lot and speak, my average age of the kids today that come see me is like 22. That's the thing I'm the most proud of. I do have youth spies, people that tell me new groups and stuff. I think that's important. But I do keep up. I don't think my day was better. I don't think the old times were better. I think tomorrow is always going to be more interesting to me. But at the same time, I'm still doing what I've always done, but I've changed with the times. I'm certainly not going to make an underground movie when we don't have them anymore. I'm not going to make a midnight movie when we have independent films. I've tried to keep up with how the films are shown and who they appeal to. But basically, I probably am the happiest I've ever been right now in my life. I think everything is going very, very well. So it's not like I'm sitting around wanting to get a facelift. I mean, I see pictures and I think, God, I mean, everybody looks in the mirror and, pulls your to see what it would look like. But it doesn't look like that. Even good facelifts of people I know, they just look like somebody else. I don't want to look like somebody else if I'm younger. I would like to. Or they look like the scary ones when you go to Los Angeles the first couple of days. I'm always like, nice to meet you. But they all look like that. It's cubist. They look like Picasso prints.
What about your body? Does your body still feel like a 12-year-old, or are you noticing?
Well, I was never known for being Mr. America. You know, if I could go to the gym to have the body of a junkie, I'd go. I'm probably the only gay man, that's never been to the baths or the gym. I like skinny, I think skinny looks good.
I was thinking of, like, aches and pains of aging and how...
Oh, I thought you were talking about body meaning, like, how it looks.
The look. Well...
Yeah. Well, let's just say I haven't been to a lot of nude beaches lately. Although, if you go to nude beaches, everyone's ugly. Have you ever been to a nude beach?
I have not.
It's the ugliest people. I'm telling you, please put your clothes on. It's never the cute ones. It's all the ugliest people that are nude. And I feel like calling the police when I go to a nude beach because no one's cute. I'm for nudity if you're cute.
No. What about the aches and pains of aging? Does that get in your way? Do you obsess on that at all?
I don't have that many aches and pains. I walk a lot. No, I don't have. I go to Provincetown in the summer. I ride my bike. I go swimming every day. I don't have that many aches and pains. Knock on wood.
Good. Now you're going to be hosting the Independent Spirit Awards, which is the Independent Film Awards put on by the Independent Film Channel.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. My guess is though that you probably. I don't mean to project thoughts on you, but let's face it, like with all genres, there's a lot of independent films that are great and a lot of independent films that are really dull.
Yep.
Like with everything, right?
Yep.
So what are your feelings now about the independent film world and the direction that it's heading in? I mean, some people say independent films are becoming more and more like other films.
Well, I believe still, though, the best are the kids that have to think of a way to get on the generation before there's nerves with whatever movie they make. Blair Witch was the last one that came out of nowhere that really did do that. It was almost like an underground movie. The difference was it grossed more than the Hollywood movies. And that scared the whole movie business a lot, the Hollywood movie business. And they all tried to repeat that, which, of course, they never could, because when these movies come along that are as original as that, you can never copy them or repeat them. I think there's some really, really good films nominated this year. I think you look at American Splendor, a lot of the ones that, even Monster, you know, have you seen Monster?
I did.
Well, it's a female impersonator movie. I think lesbian killers should all come and dress like her and yell out the dialogue like Rocky Horror Picture Show. It's the kind of movie I go for, let's face it. You know, there's a documentary about Eileen Wuornos out now that's really good, too. Part two of it, actually. I followed Eileen Wuornos's, if you could call it, career for a long time. She was... You know, I'm against the death penalty. I'm very against the death penalty. I think it was that she was insane at the time. I'm very much against the death penalty because I'm afraid I might get it. You never know. I taught in prison. Nobody that's on death row thought they were going to get it either. I mean, we have bad nights.
You have a movie coming out in the fall.
Yep, I do. It's called A Dirty Shame, and it stars Tracy Ullman and Johnny Knoxville, Selma Blair, Chris Isaac, and it's about a woman that runs a convenience store that has an accidental concussion and turns into a sex addict and meets other sex addicts who have infiltrated her neighborhood in Baltimore and plan to take it over.
And why are you making a film about sex addicts?
Well,
I need to ask.
Well, no, people say to me on the street, oh, is it about me? I guess everyone thinks they're a sex addict. I don't actually even believe in it, to tell you the truth. I read this little thing in a medical journal how a tiny percentage of head injury sufferers have a carnal lust they cannot control. So, of course, I exaggerated it into an entire movie.
Before we have to end, I want to ask you what you think about the controversy now over gay marriage. And what?
Well, I've always in my college lecture, I do this joke where I say, basically, I'm from a generation of gay men where... the privilege of being gay was that we didn't have to get married or have babies. Now, gay people have more children than Catholics. It's amazing to me. I think people have the right to be married, certainly for taxes and everything. It's not something I want to do. I don't want to imitate a fairly corny heterosexual tradition. I'm not a fan of weddings of any kind. Going to them, I never have that much fun. I go to Provincetown every summer. Now it's going to be the Niagara Falls of gay weddings. However, for the people that want to do it, I'm for it. Now, do I believe it's the most important campaign issue? I do not. I believe Iraq is more important, and I think they're going to turn it into one against the Democrats, and I think we have to be careful with that. I think everybody that wants to be married should be able to. The sanctity of heterosexual marriage, when you can get divorced 10 times, when Britney Spears can get married in one day, I don't believe in that either. So I'm certainly for the right of it, and I think it should be legal. Personally, I'm not looking to walk down the aisle. Are you kidding? It would be the last thing I would ever want to do. And as far as going in the army, you know, I have always been for an all lesbian volunteer army, and I think we would win any war.
John Waters, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Good talking to you, Terry.
John Waters' exhibition of photographs is at the New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York. The companion book is called John Waters' Change of Life. Here's a scene from one of the films represented in his exhibition, Peyton Place. Lana Turner plays a widow who hasn't been with a man in many years. Lee Phillips is the town's new high school principal. He's just kissed her.
All men are alike. The approach is different, but the result is always the same. Sooner or later, we get around to this.
Now look, if all I wanted was a woman, I could get one any place. In a bar, in a hotel lobby, on a street corner.
Or in my home.
I'm not going to let you make anything dirty out of this.
And what do you call it?
I'm going to tell you a hard truth about yourself. It isn't sex you're afraid of. You can say yes or no to that. It's love. That's what you can't handle.
And that's what you're offering me, with your hands all over me.
That's only one expression of it, backed up by many things.
Well, I haven't asked for any of them.
You'd better understand what you're saying no to. When I take you in my arms, I'm committing myself to you, not just physically, but all the way. That means that I intend to worry about you, to take care of you, to stand in front of you if there's trouble. And that's what I want back from you, without any reservations or shame or embarrassment. Now, either you're up to that or you're not.
I have my standards and my pride.
They're not enough. Not for you or for anyone else. You need someone to trust, to love.
No, I don't. I don't. Now, just leave me alone.
I can do that, too, but I don't want to. Connie, let me help you. I don't care if you hang back. If it takes time, I'll give it time. All you need.
I can't.
The offer's always open.
Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. This is Fresh Air. Director Mel Gibson's new film, The Passion of the Christ, was made with $25 million of the star's own money and shot with English subtitles. It shows the trial and crucifixion of Jesus in graphic detail. It provoked a firestorm of criticism, even in production, for allegedly favoring those Gospels that blame the crucifixion of Jesus entirely on the Jewish people. Shown to select church groups over the last several months, the film was finally unveiled for critics over the last week. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Mel Gibson had an ingenious idea for promoting his movie The Passion of the Christ as the film that the Jews don't want you to see. Bad reviews? They're not going to matter either, since Gibson has called his critics the forces of Satan, or more charitably, the dupes of Satan. Now, after Gibson's preemptive blasts, an attack on his passion is going to be interpreted by some as an attack on their religious beliefs, instead of on filmmaking that is theologically, morally, and by the way, artistically suspect. The Passion of the Christ recounts the last 12 hours of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, with flashbacks to the Last Supper and shots of the little boy Jesus being hugged by his mother, Mary. This, incidentally, while she watches spikes being hammered into his hands. The lashes of the Jewish priesthood soldiers begin about 15 minutes into the film. By the time Jesus is dragged into the presence of the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, his face has already been smashed to a pulp. Pilate, whom historians identify as a surpassingly cruel ruler, responsible for crucifying tens of thousands to maintain his authority, is portrayed as a sorrowful, even-tempered man whose wife shows acts of loving kindness towards Mary and Mary Magdalene. Pilate is shocked by the Jews' brutality and by the determination of the priest Caiaphas to see this so-called blasphemer executed. While Pilate wrinkles his forehead, searching his tender conscience, sundry Jews lean into the camera and hiss or keen through rotted teeth. I know, it sounds like a Monty Python movie. You're thinking there must be something to The Passion of the Christ besides watching a man tortured to death, right? Actually, no. This is a 2-hour and 6-minute snuff movie, The Jesus Chainsaw Massacre, masquerading as an act of faith. For Gibson, Jesus is defined not by his teachings in life, by his message of mercy, social justice, and self-abnegation, some of it rooted in the Jewish Torah, some of it defiantly personal, but by the manner of his execution. His execution, that is, as reported in the Gospel of Matthew, the anti-Semitic tone of which reflects the tension between Jews and Christians 50 years after the crucifixion, when the church's early proselytizers were trying to convert rather than incite the Roman authorities. Gibson uses every weapon in his arsenal to drive home the agony of those last 12 hours. Jesus, played by Jim Caviezel, is lashed to the point where his entire body is covered in bloody, crisscrossing canals. When he rises, amazing the Roman soldiers, they go for the scourges, which rip and puncture his flesh in slow motion, all while the Romans and the Jews cackle wildly. forced to carry his own cross. He falls again and again in slow motion on his battered body with heavy Dolby-eyes thuds. It's almost a relief when the spikes are driven into his hands and feet. At least we know the pain will eventually end. What does this exercise in sadomasochism have to do with Christianity? I don't know. I do know that Gibson is an angry man with a victimization complex. Look at his work, at the Mad Max and Lethal Weapon films, at Conspiracy Theory and The Patriot, in which he's beaten and mangled and his loved ones murdered. Look at his agonizing martyrdom in Braveheart, which ends with its hero yelling freedom as he's drawn and quartered. Gibson took the film Payback away from its writer-director to make the scenes in which his character is tortured more explicit. He added shots of his toes being smashed by a giant hammer. Payback. That's what all his movies are about. Gibson has said that he's fascinated that Jesus was whipped and scourged and mocked and spat on and had spikes driven through his hands and feet and left to die on the cross, and that he didn't think of payback. He thought of forgiveness. But by wallowing in Jesus' torture and death for 2 hours, the director of The Passion of the Christ is thinking of anything but. When Jesus is resurrected, his expression is hard, and he moves off screen with the camera lingering on a hole in his hand that goes all the way through. Mel Gibson's Jesus reminded me of the Terminator, heading out to spread the bloody word.
David Edelstein is film critic for Fresh Air and the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Bill Evans playing his composition Sugar Plum, recorded in 1971. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by BarnesandNoble.com, offering more than 30 million used and out-of-print books at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by TIAA Cref, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Well, the next Fresh Air, the neuroscience of everyday life. Journalist Stephen Johnson tells us how we're hardwired to read each other's emotions, why some sights and smells suddenly fill us with dread, and where laughter comes from. His new book is called Mind Wide Open. Join us for the next Fresh Air.